Hi and welcome to From Many People's Strength, the podcast that covers Saskatchewan politics and news. My name is Corey Johnson and my pronouns are he and him.
And I am David Richards. My pronouns are he, him, or they, them. So, jumping in.
We got some headlines.
Yeah. Small government conservatives want government to step in and prevent private industry from doing things when it personally inconveniences them. Oh, sorry, that's not the headline. I missed.
Yes, that's right. How MLA wants mayor to intervene in Willow's dispute.
How do they do this with a straight face? Like, how on earth do, like, this is someone who loses her mind when there's government overreach on stuff. And she was on the radio for years and you know, somewhat Gormley-esque. Right. Probably more toned down, but like, how do you time and time and time and time again rail against government regulations and red tape and, we shouldn't have City Hall come tell private industry what to do and, you know, private businesses, no private business, but like, you and I coming out and saying, you know what, we need to have some government regulation on things. We need to ensure there's some oversight here. Like, that would make sense, right? Like, and Sometimes we'll get caught up in personal self-interest, right? You know, I could find myself having bought property and lack of government regulations is going to impact my property value or what have you. And so, you know, yeah, I also believe in regulations, but, you know, maybe my personal interests are swaying me in a specific direction on things. But like, this is the polar opposite of her political movement's ideology. And it's not like, this isn't like, a bunch of people bought some residential property and now a sewage treatment plant is getting put in. This isn't even as bad as, like, I shouldn't say bad. This isn't even in the same vein as the issue we talked about last week where right. We were talking about a rehab facility. I personally think there's nothing wrong with a rehab facility, but that's not what this is. Like, this is a high-end – hoity-toity residential development.
Fancy.
A fancy residential development is going to change the type of fancy they're doing. And possibly slightly less fancy. But like, even then, it's going to be less golf-centric and have like other different fancy things. Like it's going to have a high-end hotel. Like, that's not a – yeah, that's not – duh. Anyways, the – I yeah. can't even get – and like a Nordic wellness spa. Like, who wakes up and goes, oh, no, I'm being hard done by. The neighborhood's going to be ruined by the Nordic wellness spa. What? Like, honestly, if it was the other way around where you had a low-income community who was scared of gentrification, I could see some concerns about that.
Yeah.
But that's not what this is. It's a high-end residential development that wants to change the type of amenities it offers in their high-end residential housing development.
Right, yeah.
But again – yeah, go on. Sorry, I've ranted long enough on this.
I just saw today in Toronto, there's a parking lot that is going to be changed into affordable housing units. And the neighborhood is putting on like a little thing. They're standing in the parking lot going, we don't want, you know, new housing. We like this parking lot or whatever. I don't remember exactly what the arguments are. But it's terrible. It's nonsense, but it's not something you don't expect.
Right.
Where, like you say, like nobody feels like defensive, like you're doing no wealthy person, no homeowner is saying, don't put up a hotel near our house.
Yeah. Apparently they are. Well, again, they're saying this isn't what they were led to believe. And that's what happens when you buy in an undeveloped area, right? Like that's Yeah. Do people not understand that? Like, In my life, I used to move around a lot as a kid. And like, one of the times we moved, we bought a house, like literally right on the edge of wilderness. Literally there was a giant forest as our next door neighbor, but it wasn't a provincial park or anything. Like it was just undeveloped land. And over the time we lived there, that changed. Like houses started getting built and like, it wasn't like we didn't say, oh, this wasn't what we signed up for. It was like, well, no, like this is we bought in on the edge of a neighborhood. There were parts of it that were undeveloped. It's zoned residential. Even with saying all of that, there are still regulations that the developer has to go through.
Right.
Like it's not even as if we're dealing with unfettered, unregulated capitalism here. It's still, you know, there's still regulations. There's still a process they have to apply for because they submitted plans to the city. Those plans got approved. Modifications have to go through a process. If I want to build a deck in my backyard, I have to go through that. And if I submit plans and the contractor changes things, I need to get it reviewed. And like, it's obviously a bigger scale than my backyard deck, but it's the same basic process. So there still is due process that this has to go through, and residents in the neighborhood can speak to the review panel and all of that, or the review process. I don't know if it's a panel, but for the idea that big government is supposed to come in and override a private business's decision on how they want to build their capitalist development seems very contrary to what the Sask Party says it stands for. And this seems to be an ongoing theme that we discuss week after week.
They like to stick their nose in things. They do like to stick their nose in municipal issues whenever it suits them. So
like, when are people going to start talking about big government conservatism, right? Like we keep talking about big government liberalism or, you know, the big government left. But in my lifetime, and I'm not young, conservatives have always been the party of big government. Like, 40 years at least. And again, I wasn't around in the 60s, but like from 1980 onward, I was four in 1980, but like 1980 onwards, and Trudeau Sr. obviously had government involvement and stuff, but like Mulroney was big government. Harper was big government, both in terms of spending and control over people's lives. In the U.S., it's similar. At the provincial level, it's similar. You know, Mo, Wall, Kenny next door, provincially across the country. The Conservative Party is the party of big government. They spend more. They run bigger deficits. They have more legislation that controls the day-to-day aspects of people's lives. They talk the big game about letting businesses be unregulated, but they still want lots of regulations in place just on different people than the ones they're complaining about. Yeah. Like they are the parties of big government. And this is just, again, such a crystal clear example of it that I don't know if you could get a better encapsulation of how ridiculous the inconsistencies are.
Right. Yeah.
Start off with a good rant there on what should be a trivial issue. Like we spent, you know, quite a few minutes, or I spent quite a few minutes ranting and on something that should be a trivial issue. Less people driving, less people crashing.
Yep.
We get money.
An average of $285 per vehicle.
I'll take it.
Yeah. I'm not turning that down.
Nope. And it's a rebate. It doesn't sound like this is going to be checks getting mailed out. This is going to be a discount on licensing, or is it actual straight up checks being sent out to people? Or did I just ask you a question you don't know the answer to?
I do not know the answer to this. Yeah, I don't know the answer to this, but honestly, either way, I'm happy.
Yeah.
It will vary based on how much you pay. I suspect like for people like me, because I had one too many accidents in 2020 that I was actually at fault at. So I owe for my points. So now this will just go towards that, whatever.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
You know, I'm sure they won't even send me money. If they are sending out checks, they'll just be like, yeah, we're keeping this
one. So this is almost a – and again, good on this ask party for doing this. This is almost a line-for-line identical policy to the one that the NDP proposed during the campaign that the Sask party mocked and made fun of and said it was undoable and not feasible and economically disastrous.
Of course.
In fact, I shouldn't say line for line. The Sask party is giving actually more money than the NDP had proposed. So this is like, again, part of that's the surplus is bigger than they were expecting, even bigger than they were expecting.
But not quite so economically disastrous.
No. So, which again is like, I'm glad, like I will clarify. I don't want this to sound like I'm criticizing the Sask party for doing the right thing.
Yeah.
I just kind of, it's one of those things where sometimes you wish they would say, you know what? Again, I'm not the type of person who the Sask party is trying to win the vote of, because I'm the type of person who a political party comes out and says, you know what? During the campaign, our opponents brought up this idea. We are the party of listening to good ideas, regardless of where they came from. We thank them for doing this. Continue to vote for us, because even when good ideas come from areas that are different from who we are, we will listen to them and implement them if they're legitimately good ideas like this one was. And we thought about, like, holy shit. Again, that would be the type of thing I would love to hear from a political party. As opposed to just pretending that it was their own idea all along, and ignoring the fact that they're implementing NDP policy. So,
but then they wouldn't be the Sask party.
But then they wouldn't be the Sask party. Fair enough. But yeah, no, it's a good idea. It's great. You have, Crown corporations are not supposed to be there for raking in profits. Like that's, they are. And the fact that like this is a win for having something being a government program, because if this was purely private insurance, that money leaves the province at this point, right? Like if we didn't have an SGI, that money's gone.
That's profits. Yeah, that's gone.
Again, you know how I feel about crowns. I'd rather, if it's good, if it's important enough to be run by the government, it should be run by the government. But, if we're going to have the middle option, again, this is one where we do see that there's benefits here in circumstances where there's, where we as the users of the program actually get the money back. So.
Car dealerships, real estate developers among top donors for Regina mayoral candidates. Democracy Watch says campaign contributions should have been released months sooner. And I believe there are still candidates who have not released their donations.
Correct.
But at this point, it's almost moot.
Yeah. So the winners. I'm going to be slightly sarcastic and hyperbolic here. The ones who didn't release, I think their donations were 3 nickels and a bubblegum wrapper. So
so who cares?
And again, I'm being a little facetious there.
Right.
It's one of those weird things where you kind of like wish donations were being publicly available in real time. Like maybe leading into the election.
Right.
Before we vote, we get to know this stuff. That'd be neat.
Yep.
Because I'm not going to remember any of this. I pay attention to politics. I'm not going to remember any of this in 4 years. Like in 4 years from now, I am not going to remember who donated to Sandra Masters in 2016.
It was clear during the campaign that somebody had more money than others. Like there were giant Sandra Masters billboards in various places around the city. Yeah. And I didn't see that for a lot of other people.
And I think they both were pretty close. The maximum amount they're allowed to accept is $68,776, which I have to assume was a specific round dollar amount at some point and has been indexed over time, because that's a weird amount.
Yeah.
But both Fougere and Masters were virtually at that level. And then everyone else was significantly less.
Pretty far away,
So Masters received money from car dealerships. This is probably the biggest individual, and like quite a few car dealerships by the sounds of things. So,
which is interesting.
It would have been interesting to know that in advance.
Yeah.
But
I mean, yeah. I think we're probably on record. Like, I was not going into the election thinking that Sandra Masters was going to be the person I wanted to win. So in a sense, this wouldn't have changed my vote, but it might have changed somebody else's vote.
Like, Michael Fougere has a long history with the Home Builders Association and the construction industry in the city. So, like, there had, like, back when he was a city councilor, so even before he was mayor, there had always been questions about his involvement with zoning decisions and some of the, was he actually looking out for the city's best interest, or was he looking out for the best interest of developers and business? At the end of the day, like, municipal politicians are always going to have to be somewhat beholden to businesses.
We don't have, like, there's not a system set up where they don't have to take these donations from businesses,
yeah,
and can instead campaign in another way. But
And they talk about how, you know, the donations of the past won't impact the decisions of the future, and
yeah, right.
Like, I guess they're claiming to be robots. I don't know.
I'm sure that they can hold true to that.
I'm being sarcastic, but, like, I will admit, I'm a human being. If someone gave me $10,000, I would be predisposed to liking them.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't you? Right? Like, if someone walked up to you and said, hey, here's $10,000, no strings attached, no questions asked, I might give you more again in 4 years. And then in 2 years from now, they come up to you and ask you for a favor.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Right? And I'm not saying they will. And I'm not saying I would either. If something vastly went against my beliefs, I would like I could resist that. I could like to think, no, that doesn't align with my beliefs. It's not what's best for my constituents and all that. But if I'm on the fence, I don't know how, like, that's going to be in there. That's going to be in the back of my mind, and not even consciously. Like, humans have implicit biases, right? We are influenced by our preconceived notions. It's just human nature. So, and again, that isn't even faulting Sandra Masters or Fougere, right? Like, that's just a
human being.
Humans work. So,
I think that came out a lot during the recent stuff with Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers and stuff is in the US, like, they're not allowed to actually pay doctors to prescribe their drugs, but they can do favors and they can take them out for dinner and they can, you know, do this and that and the other thing. And they can invite them to speak at a conference that they do pay them for and stuff like that. And I mean, this is well documented way of manipulating people to doing what you want. It's once you are invested with somebody, if they have done you favors, then you always are more inclined to do things for them. And this is why we need to do away with campaign donations. But
And, like, I'll be fair. Like, I don't know. Like, if you do away with campaign donations, I don't know, I guess, what the solution is. And again, I don't know if this is, maybe this is a problem you don't need to worry about. And it just, but how do you prevent 40 unserious candidates running?
Yeah, no, that's true.
Right? Like,
yeah,
I don't want to have 40 people who just decide to throw their hat in the ring because they're fine. And because at the federal level and provincial level, like, there's that party, there's the party system, right? And the last thing I want is more power to parties, because I think we need more independence. But the fact of the matter is, we do have a party system, and that is a large part of how campaign financing was generated previously. But the other issue with that is it also, like, supports the winners. You're basing it on popular vote share in the previous election, that really entrenches. So, like, there are issues with any campaign finance reform system.
That's true.
Like I said, we started talking about this, I think one of the solutions is you disclose in advance. If you're bought and paid for, you're like,
own people it, where, know.
Yeah, like Jon Stewart years ago made the joke about people should, or politicians should have NASCAR jackets, where just like the NASCAR jackets that are covered with the logos of who the sponsors are, doing something similar for politicians. And I don't think it needs to be to that degree, but In this article, Democracy Watch makes the suggestion of, you know, weekly disclosures leading into the election. Big dollar donations have that threshold lowered for when that's considered, or even just lower the amount of what the maximum campaign donation can be. So like those are all some options. And
I probably do recommend a podcast or something on every episode, but there's actually a great book that discusses like the way the effects of like favors and stuff. Like it's called Mistakes Were Made by Not, But Not By Me. It's an exploration of implicit bias and some of the ways that we can be manipulated into doing things that are actually against our beliefs.
Oh yeah, I'm not surprised by it. But it's a lot of people, when the Citizens United decision came out in the United States, everyone made a big deal about the whole, oh, it treats corporations as people, which I get why people were upset by that concept, but that wasn't really what Citizens United did. Corporations have existed effectively as people for hundreds of years. Like that is what a corporation is. A corporation is an entity that functions similar to a human the world, right? Like that's Citizens United tinkered with that a little bit, but that concept had been around for a while. What Citizens United did was they said spending money is the same thing as speech. If I give you $100, that is a form of speech. And I think
Restrict that, then we're restricting
it's a restriction of free speech, right? So I think for me, that was where I think that philosophy somewhat has seeped in across the Canadian side of the border as well. We kind of start having a little bit of that thought process as well. And I understand the rationale behind it. And that's a bigger issue than we'll talk about here. But I think it's a dangerous mindset to have when it comes to campaign finance. So,
yeah, if dollars are speech, then the person with the most dollars gets to say whatever they want. And the person with the least doesn't get any speech.
Yeah.
So
that's that sums it up. So, and again, we'll see what happens next election. And, again, I don't know, we'll see if there's any pro car dealership legislation. I don't know what that would even look like. Yeah, I'm not sure. But I can see issues around zoning and issues around like if car dealers, you know, one of the plus things, maybe I'm being optimistic here, is when car dealerships want to implement the infrastructure that allows them to sell electric cars, because most dealerships can't sell electric cars because there's infrastructure issues involved with doing that. I've discovered that when I went to buy an electric car 7 years ago. But, So maybe this will make it easier for car dealerships to start selling electric cars. That's my optimistic takeaway.
Good. Our last sort of quick one.
Yeah.
Harsh reality, 22 staff laid off as Lighthouse North Battleford shelter forced to close. And this is a shelter. Lighthouse in North Battleford will close in April due to a lack of funding. And I mean, it sucks that there's 22 people who are going to lose their job. It's also shitty that there's 37 people that won't be able to have shelter there if they need it. So I'm not sure how they're going to house those people, where that's going to happen.
I do. Jail is how they will house them.
No, that's true.
Right? We're going to save $500,000 and, or I guess where's the money actually is the Provincial Métis Housing Corporation. So the government will likely save $500,000 and spend an extra $1 million to pick up the difference.
Yep.
Right? Yep. Like that's what we do. We are, you know, literally, you know, spending, you know, or save a penny, spend a pound, right? Like it's the opposite of what we're supposed to do. We find ways of cutting costs on things that are preventative and spend more money on dealing with the after effects.
Yeah, and then we have to spend more on policing, and we spend more on prison, and
yep.
Not that and we don't fund know that. Those very well, or no. Prisons very well, but
no. And again, this will have impacts on mental health, and it'll have impacts in other ways too, right? Like this will put a strain on other aspects of our system.
Yeah.
You know, even the Lighthouse itself is more of a Band-Aid than I would we know. And again, this is one of those things where I know you've been somewhat frustrated with some of the lack of compassion within the skeptic community, atheist community, whatnot. Like, yeah. But like, this is one of those ones where I struggle with how people who can say they are pro-science or pro-logic or pro-math aren't left-wing, and how people who are left-wing don't end up being pro-science and pro-skepticism and pro-math.
Right. The two seem to go hand in hand.
And again, that's my implicit bias. I'd like to think I'm both of those things. I'm sure there are things where I fuck up the science or I fuck up the logic because my own biases get in the way.
Right.
But when it comes to housing, like, this has been studied. Like, we know this. And this isn't even one of those, oh, you left-wingers think things in theory, right? Like, oh, this is just a theory. No, like,
no.
We've seen it in practice in places that implement housing first policies around homelessness. It costs the government less money in the, like, I was going to say in the long run, but like in the short run, it even costs the government less money. Like in the medium short run, at least, like that has returns almost immediately. And it's, the reason people don't want to do this isn't because of cost savings. It isn't because of fiscal responsibility. It isn't because of being economically it's because they don't want to have people get something they don't deserve. It's that sense of – that's that weird sense of fairness and quote unquote fairness.
Yeah, that's because it's not fairness, right?
It's not fair. No. No, but they want to think it is. They want to think it is – they want to – it's the just world hypothesis, right? They want to believe we live in a just world, because if we live in a just world, everything they have was justly earned. And if someone who doesn't currently have a home to live in is given one for
– choices.
Yeah. And if they're given one for free, that's, you know, somehow a slight against them who had to work for what they have.
Right.
Not taking into account, like – I would like to think I worked hard. I have a lot of luck in my life, tons of luck in my life as far as privilege and both other things that have come about. I have a number of privileges that have led to me to where I am. The type of home that people get, quote unquote, for free in a housing first policy is not as nice as mine. Like, that is right. the fruits of my labor are still mine. The hard work I put into having nice things, I still get to keep those nice things. I think that's probably true for 99.9% of the people who are upset about these policies. They will, like, you will still have nicer things than the shelter that is given as a relief measure so that people who are going through a rough time can get back on their feet. And the people who make use of these services, again, we see this time and time again as well, they also want nice things.
Yeah.
Right? Like, humans want to feel a sense of accomplishment. It is one of our driving forces. We don't, as a species, we do not want to sit around and do nothing.
No, that's right.
You watch science fiction where there's these utopian worlds, and they're always secretly dystopian when all is said and done, right? Captain Kirk shows up and goes, no, you don't want everything handed to you on a silver platter. You want to work for it. Because we do, because we see that as the audience and go, oh, that is kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
And it's nice for vacation, right? We all like to have a month or two, or maybe a year or two. But you even say to people, if you, and because in my job, one of the questions I end up asking people in my sort of early conversations when I'm helping people out is, you know, if money wasn't a factor in your life, if you had all the money that you could ever need to do whatever you want, what would your life look like? What would look different in your life right now? And everyone works. They don't say, they don't want to work in their current job in a lot of cases.
Right.
But everyone's answer will involve some form of doing labor, whether it's, you know, donating their time to charity, not just their money, but their time to charity, working at food banks, helping out at literacy programs, working with children. You know, they want to learn a craft, and, you know, I want to learn how to build a boat in my spare time. Everyone wants to work and do things. And in these circumstances, again, you see this with these housing first policies, is when they're implemented, the people who, once they're on their feet, once they no longer have to spend every single waking moment focused on survival,
yeah,
now they can start moving their way up the hierarchy of needs, and they can start, quote unquote, being the responsible functioning members of society, contributing members of society, whatever word you want to use. And right, they do start, you know, generating revenue for the tax base, because they want to work, they want to earn a living. And they, like, these aren't the nicest facilities. They want to move out and start getting work elsewhere and earning a nicer home that's theirs. They want to be able to, you know, put up paintings on the wall or posters on the wall or personalize things on the wall. These are all things people want to be able to do. And you see it time and time again in places that have implemented these policies. It doesn't take long. You give someone 6 months of not worrying about whether they're going to sleep on the street that night, they will find ways of building. Humans like building things, building in our life, building in our community. So that's my thoughts. And again, it is so frustrating that this has to close. And
yeah.
So, and hopefully, again, the NDP is calling on the provincial government to come in and backfill the funding shortage, and hopefully they do. And more so, hopefully we can start, you know, finding ways of not just putting Band-Aids on things.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we're going to do a bit deeper dive on a couple topics now.
And I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on this one. So you have direct impact.
So this particular article is referring to Good Eats is closing. It's downtown in Regina. There's one in Saskatoon, which apparently is staying open. And they're discussing how Skip the Dishes, DoorDash, Uber Eats, these often take as much as 30% off the top of the food that they're ordering or delivering. So I guess that means 30% off the top means then the 70% that the restaurant keeps, they then have to pay for food, labor, materials, power, all that, their expenses come out of the 70%, which is bad, right? Like, obviously 30% is way too high.
Do the drivers get paid out of that 30%?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We get paid out of that. Plus, if somebody tips, then we get an additional on top of that. Usually we get about... Well, it varies, but I'd say the average delivery is about 60 cents per kilometer.
Okay.
Now, to do the delivery job, it costs about 57 cents a kilometer. So at the base pay, we often are just barely getting enough to cover our costs.
Right.
So part of my concern with this, and I of course, I support restaurants, and I support... The desire to have a change in the system so that they're not paying 30% right off the top.
Yeah.
But there needs to be some level of control in that bill or amendment, whatever they're going to do, that says you cannot take this out of the wage you pay your workers.
Yeah.
And if you don't control whether or not they are allowed to add another fee onto the customer, then they will do that. Like they did in BC, they added a 99 cent fee on every order to the customer's end. They call it a BC fee.
Yeah.
So
the delivery fee. So like if I order from wherever, Jimbo Joe's Steak Emporium, and Jimbo Joe says, you know, here are my costs, but it's $4.95 for delivery. Who gets that $4.95? Is that also split 70-30?
No.
Or do you know? Okay.
As far as I know, that goes 100% to the delivery company, to the app company. And then they give us a portion of that.
But then why would it be different from one restaurant to another? Because that varies. That has a huge variance from one restaurant to another.
I think
who decides that?
It's somewhere in the app.
Okay.
Somewhere in the business, they assign those. And I think often it's based on distance, right? If you are ordering from someplace that's really close, like DoorDash has somewhere, if I order them, I'll pay 99 cents as my delivery fee.
Huh, okay.
So then they have to take the remainder of my delivery person's pay out of the what they're getting from the restaurant.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because it seems like even two restaurants that are side by side, I've seen vastly different. And some have the, if it's over a certain threshold of money, you'll get it
zero.
For, yeah, then it's free, right? So, I'm going to be honest, that BC fee, that I don't have a problem with, honestly. Well, if they're providing, like, I'd rather see that. What I would actually rather see is 100% or 95% of whatever the app says I'm paying goes to the restaurant. And then...
Yeah.
DoorDash or Skip the Dishes or whoever gets to charge me whatever they want to charge me for delivery. Because that then I'm paying them for delivery. Yeah. I'm paying them for the service they're providing. Yeah. But I like things being visible and upfront. I don't like things being hidden.
Yeah, it is a little shady the way that it's set up. And I think that part of the way that they're justifying it within DoorDash and Uber Eats and stuff is that they justify that as an advertising fee as well. So they think that, like, if you're in the app and you're browsing, then you'll see the restaurant that pays whatever for.
And they're not wrong.
Yeah.
Like, that is how I just discover certain restaurants, right?
Yeah. What is that worth, right?
Yeah. And is this a system where this type of regulation, is it protecting the delivery services from themselves? Because if these services drive enough businesses out of business, it's going to hurt them in the long term too.
Yeah.
Weird.
Like I am not privy to the actual facts of it necessarily, but I have been informed by restaurant owners and people who say they know that McDonald's isn't paying the same 30% that the Chinese food place is paying, right? They do it because they're on such a mass scale that they can say, oh, well, we're only going to give you this much of our, bill, and you got to figure the rest out if you want us on, otherwise, McDonald's isn't going to be on your app.
Well, and like McDonald's is one where McDonald's has its own delivery app. Now, that delivery app doesn't work in Regina, or at least doesn't work where I live. I tried using it the other day and it just, you can't use it.
Okay.
But it was one of those ones where I was like, well, if I use their delivery app and I end up not getting McDonald's for this very reason, I got to the end, I had, they apply the coupons and da, 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 da. And when all was said and done, it was going to cost like, $18 for the food to get delivered for me and my kids. And I was like, okay, well, I can't do it. I won't do it. So I'll go into Skip the Dishes. And with Skip the Dishes, it was like $30 for the exact same food. I'm like, oh, I guess I'm not doing McDonald's then. Right, like at $30 for me and my kids, I'm like, I'm going to order from. And I think I got I Love Sushi instead, and it was better food for the same price. Not sponsored.
But I Love Sushi is awesome.
I Love Sushi is fantastic. Their portions are enormous. It's great. This one I'm not going to talk about. There's another restaurant who I went to fairly frequently. I quite like their food. And this actually happened before COVID. Ordered through Skip for pickup because they didn't want to pay the $5 delivery fee and go to pick it up. And when I'm picking it up, they're like, hey, just – so, next time, if you wouldn't mind, could you just order through our own website instead of ordering through Skip the Dishes if you're just going to do pickup anyways? Like, if you're doing delivery, sure. But, like, if you're doing pickup anyways, would you mind just ordering through us? I'm like, you know what? Sure. That sounds totally reasonable. So the next time I did, I went to order through them, and it was $10 more expensive when I went through them rather than going through Skip the Dishes. And it's like for the same food, like literally the exact same food. I'm like, fuck, well, I want to support
now I'm
you.
Not gonna do that.
I want to support you, but no.
Yeah.
So some of the stuff is it's arcane. It's all new territory as well, right? No one knows what they can get away with.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, I'm a little bit, I have my perspective, right? Yeah. Like, I think I'm an anti-capitalist. I look at this situation and I see a company charging restaurant, 30%.
Yep.
And then the law comes in and they say, okay, well, you can't charge them 30%.
Yeah.
And immediately my pay goes down. Yeah. Like, unless you're stopping that from happening, I'm losing money now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So if you want to protect workers, then you have to have some provision in the bill that limits the cap percentage they can take, and yeah, that says they can't take that out of, because they're not going to take it out of their profits if they can help it.
Yeah. I also think workers should get paid wages and salaries.
Yes. Like, yes. Ideally.
This independent contractor thing.
Yeah.
To me is a backdoor manipulation of the law. And labor laws, like,
yep,
just saying, oh, they're not employees, they are independent contractors, when they function like employees. And we don't let people get away with that for taxes, right? Like, you're not allowed to declare small business expenses. You can, I'm assuming you can declare, you know, your car and your mileage and all of those work expenses. But you can't, like, if you were making enough money that you didn't need every dollar you earned, you couldn't say, oh, I'm leaving retained earnings within my professional corporation. It's not the same as a doctor or a lawyer who has a professional corporation where they can leave retained earnings for tax benefits and all of that. The government makes sure it's getting its money and not letting you basically do a loophole. And there's rules around that, right? Like, there's rules around when something is actually a company hiring another company and when is something hiring an employee and they're being like, and it's an actual employee.
Right.
And if we can enforce those rules when it comes to taxing people, there's no reason we can't enforce those rules when it comes to labor laws. Like, that, the fact that we don't is a choice.
Yep. It's kind of a mess. Mm-hmm. Like, the fact that, I don't see it happen here, but in other cities, they have restaurants where they have what they call the table of shame. And these are the $3 or $4 orders that nobody wants to take because it's not worth it to take such a small order.
Right.
And sometimes orders will sit there for an hour, 2 hours. Now, if we're paid employees with a guaranteed wage on some level, then we will take those orders, you know, and you're not forced to tip in order to bid on a contractor taking your order, right?
Right.
Like, you know, if you can't afford to tip, then you can just order your food and know that I'm still getting a decent wage for my travel.
Yeah.
So it benefits everybody except for DoorDash, essentially, or Skip the Dishes.
But again, if your business model requires breaking the law, then that's not a good business model.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's how we work other businesses, right? If I have a business where my business model is going around the city, going rifling through everyone's backyard, stealing things, and then reselling the things I steal on Craigslist or Used Regina.
No overhead.
Right? Like, I'm not allowed to do that. I'm not allowed to just go around stealing from people and reselling it. And even if I could find a way, like, if I found a sneaky way of some legal loophole that allowed me to do that, then we don't just as a society say, he found a way to steal from people without getting caught. I guess we won't do anything. We say, okay, let's close that loophole. Like, that's how we do things. And wage theft is theft. If someone has found a way of manipulating the system in order to create a legalized wage theft, then that's not a good business model.
No, that's right.
And yeah, we need to fix that. A great meme I saw the other day talked about, you know, when we we don't treat all, like the whole idea of we don't treat all theft as equal. We, you know, if we think about how the power dynamic works in society, if you have an employee somewhere who accidentally has $100 from the till in their pocket and walks out and gets caught, at best they're getting fired, you know, and they could very well see jail time, or at least that, you know, the police could get involved. But you have $100 worth of wage theft. If it gets caught, it will get re-added back to someone's paycheck in 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? With no negative consequences. Yeah. Like if an employer accidentally shortchanges someone, we don't treat that as a crime. We don't treat that as theft. And obviously that's not what this is, but
right.
If someone is an employee of a company, they should be getting paid. And if they incur work-related expenses, that should be reimbursed by the company.
Yeah.
Like that's just how business works. If you know, someone's driving a truck for their job, the gas is paid for by who they're driving the truck for. Or again, if you're talking about, you know, long haul trucking, you know, then you're starting to deal with greater levels of compensation that exceed what that would work out to.
Regina Mayer supports a ban on conversion therapy. Like, to me, this is obviously a good thing. I thought conversion therapy was overall illegal in Canada.
It is. So, it is banned on a federal level. Many other jurisdictions, both provincially and municipally, are implementing additional bans at their level. It is somewhat symbolic. There are reasons why it's important to have it at municipal and provincial levels in addition to federal levels, because there's different aspects under the law as to how, like, what can be covered and what can't, because provincial, federal, municipal all have different areas of authority when it comes to legislation.
Right.
So that's sort of why there's a push to have it implemented at the municipal level. Okay. There's also the idea that, you know, governments don't remain forever. And if, you know, next year or, you know, the government falls and we get a conservative government in who repeals the ban at a federal level, it will still be in place at the lower levels of government. Or if we start finding it's not getting enforced at the federal level, you have other ways of doing it. There's a couple different issues that come out when you talk about a conversion therapy, because who's going, like, you know, when it's children going to conversion therapy, like, that is child abuse. Like, that's, I'm not going to pull punches. It is pseudoscience that literally has shown to drive children to suicide and severe lifelong mental health issues. Like, this is pretty cut and dry. And like, we, like, the, there's the conversion therapy that existed 10, 20 years ago, this isn't the conversion therapy 50 years ago. Literally 10 years ago, it involved literally electrocuting children in order to make them not gay anymore. The idea now, oh no, it's a softer, fuzzier, conversion therapy. We no longer electrocute children. Now we just torture them mentally. I think most, obviously there's a fringe who disagrees with this, and I'm going to continue to treat them like a fringe. Unfortunately, it's a larger fringe than I would like, but I guess within sort of more mainstream political thought, there is a outside belief currently that it should be allowed for children. I think most mainstream political thought agrees that banning this for children is a no-brainer. There is some controversy around banning it for adults, in that the idea being, if there is an adult who knowingly and willingly chooses to undergo this therapy, should it be the government's place to deny that if they are going in not coerced through their own volition? And my thought on this is, and again, is treating the two issues somewhat separately. When it comes to the overall issue of, you know, conversion therapy, in quotation marks, conversion therapy. The word therapy is a specific term that falls under treatment guidelines for mental health care. We don't allow unlicensed people who are not qualified to be doctors to perform knee surgery. Open up Dr. Dave's wacky knee surgery emporium. I'm not allowed to do that.
Yeah.
Even if you say, oh, you know what? Dave makes a good point that he can do knee surgery on me that will let me fly. I think that's brilliant. I really think that I would like to be able to fly.
Which is true.
Yeah. I'd like to be able to jump 10 feet in the air. And Dave's wacky knee surgery emporium has promised me that I can jump 10 feet in the air if I let Dave do his chop open my knee and install a spring. I'm not allowed to do that. I'm legally prohibited from opening up Dave's knee surgery emporium because we have rules around what people can say is healthcare and what they can't. And I think when it comes to if it's not, again, I don't know how you can legislate against someone going into their church and talking to their priest and their priest saying, you know what? I understand you have these urges. But you know, God wants you to not act on them. I don't know any legislation that I would want to see that would make that illegal. I think we need to have awareness of how harmful that is. And I think we need to, not as the government, but we as individuals need to make sure we are communicating out in the world that that is not okay. If someone is saying that to you, you need to walk away from anyone saying that. But I don't know of any law I would want that would allow the government to prohibit a priest from having that conversation with someone who doesn't want to be gay. I don't want to criminalize lying to people, even if I believe lying to people is immoral. And saying, yes, you can stop being gay if you just try really hard or pray really hard. But you can't call that therapy. You can't imply that that has a basis in science, and you can't imply that that has a basis in medicine or mental health care.
Right.
And that piece of thing, I think when people start talking about and Don Hauer up in Saskatoon was the only city councilor to vote against it. And that was his argument. Oh, we can't legislate what people are allowed to do and say. And if people want to do this willingly, I'm like, sure. I can drink Coca-Cola, but what Coca-Cola can't do is say drinking Coca-Cola will cure cancer. They can't say that. I can still have a glass of Coke if I want. And you can still go to your priest and have a conversation with your priest. Your priest just can't call that therapy.
Yeah.
When it comes to children, my belief is at that point, I don't fucking care what you call it. Don't abuse children. You can't do it. They are not old enough to consent to what you are doing to them. And I think that is where we as a society need to step in and say, you know, there are lines. Children, my children are not my property. They are. I have a duty to them. I have a duty to them to protect them. I have a duty to them to provide for them, keep them safe. And I have a number of things around that. I am essentially given the responsibility to make some decisions for them that fall outside their capacity because while there are blurred areas around autonomy until they're 18, there are some decisions I get to make for them. But at a certain point,
some things are just a lot. Some things are beyond the parent's choice.
Yeah.
Because that's something we hear in a lot of cases is vaccine, anti-vax parents. They often say it's my child, my choice. I mean, there's religious groups who deny their children medical intervention that say, like, this is our religious choices. These are our children. This is how we run this. And, I mean, there are things that you do that are harmful to the child that you are in charge of, that you are supposed to be caring for. Yep. And these things, whether they're philosophical, religious, whatever, they need to be prohibited if they harm the child. Yep. It's just how it is.
And this is another one of those ones where there is a blurry line where that falls. Like, there is a gray area. There are questions. I don't know certain things what side of that line it should fall on. In fact, in most cases, I probably fall more along the lines of I do think parents are most likely to be the best arbiters of best interest
in most cases, right?
Like do I make choices sometimes that may not have been optimal? Should I have let my kids have that extra 3 hours of screen time Saturday morning? Probably not. I probably should have been more firm about, you know, you have homework due for Monday. You have to set aside, you know, probably a good hour to work on it. Let's do it Saturday morning instead of leaving it till, you know, Sunday at 8. Those are choices where, you know, I probably am not acting in my kids' best interest, but I chose the path of least resistance. One, like, I don't want the government stepping in and stepping on my toes
But there's legitimately harm done.
End of the spectrum, I don't want to start getting into horror stories, but I think we can all think of horrific things we have heard of parents doing to children that we know for certain should be illegal. Like, I don't think I've ever met someone who says there is nothing that shouldn't be considered child abuse. Like, everyone has a line, and then we just come down to where that line needs to be. And where I get frustrated is there needs to be a good faith acceptance of the fact that a line exists. Because where I get frustrated is on so often in these conversations, the argument is, oh, well, if you're making, like, it's the slippery slope, right? It's, oh, if you're going to make this illegal, what about that? Like, let's start with the base understanding. There has to be a line. Like, if you're not willing to acknowledge a line needs to exist somewhere, you're not entering this conversation in good faith. If we can start at that common agreement that there needs to be a line somewhere, then we can start engaging on where that line needs to be. And on the issue of conversion therapy, I think you can have a conversation. I have personal bias on this. But you need to be able to come to, and I think you need to be able to come to the table with the understanding that the line needs to be at some point. I think if you honestly think running an electric current through an 8-year-old in order to make, or a 12-year-old in order to make them not have feelings of a certain kind you don't like.
Anybody who thinks that that isn't child abuse is clearly just making excuses, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. So from there, okay, we both agree that running an electric current through a teenager is bad. Yeah. That's abusive. That should be illegal. We probably both agree that we shouldn't make it illegal for teenagers to read the Bible.
Probably not.
Like, that's
I think it's a bad influence, but I don't think they can ban it. So the line is somewhere in between.
Between those two, now we can start figuring out where that line should be. Yeah, that's right. So, but again, that's not what this is. These bans are not. They are not preventing 12-year-olds from reading the Bible. This is much, much closer to the don't allow electrocution of 12-year-olds, and it's more involved in the you're not allowed to advertise a medical service that you're not licensed to provide.
Yeah, they're not even actually, like, they're not even criminalizing parents telling their children that being gay is a sin or, like, you know, so we're already, you know, on the line where I think it's actually mentally abusive, so is still legally not prohibited in any way. And I mean, not that you could, but it is.
Yeah.
But.
Yep.
I guess, whatever.
No, I think at the point where you start dictating that, I think you lose the ability to call yourself an anarchist. When you want that level of state control.
Yeah. That's not even a thing you could literally.
You literally can't. So it's a moot point on whether you think it should be, right? So, and I think we're somewhat walking around in circles at this point. This is a practice that is scientifically proven not to work. It is scientifically proven to be harmful. There are peer reviewed academic studies that have looked into this. There is a wealth of scientific research, World Health Organization, Canadian Psychological Association, psychological organizations around the world, have studied this and declared it ineffective and harmful. So like, this isn't something where the science is still out. Good for me. Right.
Oh, go ahead.
One last point, though. Sorry. I will give one other point. I should have said this one sooner. Because this is multiple levels of government, all that. This is an important symbol. It is going to be largely symbolic. I think the other facet of this that you need to always talk about as well is words are great and actions are better. And dollars are really where the rubber meets the road. So if as a city we're going to say – if as a city people want to support the gender and sexually diverse community, if the city council and mayor wants to support the gender and sexually diverse community, there needs to be money put where the mouth is, and funding for healing, funding for services that help gender and sexually diverse youth that are impacted to a greater degree, homelessness, there are issues around poverty. We know gender and sexually diverse youth from other marginalized communities are exponentially impacted greater because of the intersection of different oppressions. We need to put funding and time and energy into actually solving the harms that were done by generations upon generations of homophobia and transphobia, to actually begin healing rather than just a ban on conversion therapy. So that's my final soapbox of the episode.
Sounds good. All right. You can find us at anchor.fm/frommanypeoples. Our Twitter is at @SKPoliticsPod. Facebook is facebook.com/frommanypeoplesstrengthpod. And you can email us at frommanypeoples@gmail.com. I set up a buy me a coffee account for us. So if you want to buy us a coffee, you can go there and buy us a coffee.
Awesome.
buymeacoffee.com/frommanypeoples. And my Twitter is at @HardcoreSkeptic. And David is at @DBR_storyteller. So, all right. That's it.
All right. Have a great week, Corey. Thanks again for organizing everything.
Thank you. Have a good one.